Yes, dear Mr. Shepherd, my husband Charles and I listen to your program every night. Actually, we're John Gambling listeners. We've enjoyed Mr. Gambling now for over 45 years. And Charles would never think of going to bed without including Mr. Gambling and Martha Dean in his prayers. Well, actually, Mr. Shepherd, the reason I am writing to you is because, Mr. Shepherd, we enjoy very much your acrid, cutting comments on the world in which we live. But as far as your reminiscences about your ridiculous, rotten Midwestern boyhood, you are a complete bore. Mr. Shepherd, lay off, will you? And as far as those insane noises, those ridiculous, silly noises that you are continually making, I have no use whatsoever for them. Signed, a disgusted ex-listener. A disgusted... Yes.
What's that? That's not Narcissus. That's the Hannibal Choir getting ready to march over the Alps. You know, now we're on the subject of acrid comments on our society. And it's Monday, you know, crying out loud, nobody listening. Everybody's on the West Coast or someplace. One thing I've noticed about the acrid comment about our society is that everyone seems to feel that sinister things are afoot. Well, sinister things are really, I don't know, history is a difficult thing to wrestle with, especially when it's wrestling with you and it has a larger grip than you have. It's all right, just watch. It's going to be that Narcissus will be the next one, all this excitement there. Just anything else you want to know before we go? All right, all set then. Okay. Well, I, over the weekend, you see, I'm sitting there and I can't figure it out. How many of you feel as I do that more than we really want to know, or more than we really would ever admit, is being said about our world inadvertently, day in and day out, by people who are using the communication media in a very innocent way, but a very pointed way and a very naive way to attain a certain specific goal? In short, you will find out a great deal more about our world by watching commercials than you will by watching the shows in between. Now, I mean that. I'm talking about if you watch it as a sociologist or a psychologist, not necessarily as a beer drinker, you will find usually more care and more work and a devil of a lot more production values go into the commercials than ever go into the shows, believe me. Where there's a budget to be cut, it's cut between the commercials. There are some commercials, for example, that are really, in a way, masterpieces of ingenuity. You wonder just what these guys who dream this stuff up could do if they put it to good use. You know, really. You just wonder, all this fantastic pile of potatoes and no meat. It really is an incredible thing. I've watched so many productions and television productions and TV commercial producers work. I've done some commercials myself. I've been around in that field. And I know this, for one thing, that it's pretty obvious to those of you who watch. But as far as the care, the worry, the poking and the working and the dissecting and the casting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that goes on a TV commercial. If this was applied to the show, forget it, Dad. We'd have the greatest television in the world. Now, what probably makes this so interesting to me is that because the people are concentrating on doing something with what they do rather than doing it for its own sake, you will find more truth in what they do than people who are, say, trying to produce an art. Now, this is not an anti-intellectual comment here. What I'm saying is this, that an artist, when he's working in his medium, he's working away, he's a painter, he's a poet, he's whatever he has to be, he's reflecting his own ego, he's working with his medium as best he can, and in general, it's its own end. It is not a functional piece of goods. And for that reason, the truth that's contained in it is a very relative, minor truth. It is an individual truth, which can be fantastic and can be minor. But on the other hand, a man who is doing a commercial is touching upon all kinds of subtle things in people all over everywhere, or else he isn't going to be doing commercials long. I'll tell you this, just as quick as that. You'd be surprised how quick that stuff shows up at the cash register. Now, I'm not talking about an old-fashioned pitch man who is up there. And, oh, and by the way, he too has his place. Because an old-fashioned pitchman, you take five guys in a row, all selling the same object. One guy may even have a higher price than the other four selling that object, but somehow he sells more of them than the other four. What is he doing? What subtleties is he working in? What genuine fears is he playing upon? What sneakiness is he working in? What kind of areas of discontent is he dealing in? It's an area that is truly fraught, truly fraught. For example, the other day I'm watching, this is over the weekend, I'm watching a ball game, see? And I'm sure that all of you have you ever wondered why, when you watch a beer commercial, there is nothing as strangely fantasy-like as a beer. Now most beer commercials today bear a very generic relationship with cigarette commercials. Have you noticed that? Somehow it's the same crowd. In one sense they're drinking, in another sense they're smoking. It's the same clean-limbed group running around on the beach and yelling. Now, have you noticed that? One minute they're smoking like they're fiends, and the next minute they're drinking like they're out of their skull. Now, and both of these commercials are directed at a single line, and that is to forget the end product of what the product is they sell, the end result. Now they never would suggest that anybody drinks a bottle of beer to get a bag on in one of these commercials. Never. He would never suggest that at all. Never. Like the other day, I'm watching a cigarette commercial, and there's a guy, a very unhappy-looking guy, see, and he's sitting in his car, and he says, "You know, Charlie, I've been smoking for 3 hours. I've been smoking all these cigarettes for 3 hours, and they taste rotten. I don't know what I'm smoking for." Well, then he turns to the guy, and he says, "Well, Fred, of course, you're smoking for good taste, and here's one." And he flips him one, and the guy smokes it, and of course, naturally, his eyes light up, and he's discovered Nirvana. Well, now, inadvertently, the cigarette people are tipping off that the first guy is hooked. Even if they taste rotten, he's going to smoke. They never say that. They always say, the reason you smoke is for good taste. And yet, it is a proven fact in the laboratory, and I've seen this done time and time again. I don't forget this done in a psychology class. Smokers all believe, you know, it's a mystic belief that they can tell their cigarette from all others. Well, forget it, Dad. You won't be able to do it if all the cigarettes are unbranded and nine of them are given to you in a row. The chances of you picking out your cigarette out of that nine are purely the same chances of picking out any brand out of the nine that you don't even know. In other words, it's purely coincidental. And I hear all kinds of cigarette smokers say, "Oh, no, this guy's nuts, I know. Parliament's like tell every time." No. You remove the various tricky filters and you just, you know, so that you can't identify it by the kind of filter and you wouldn't be able to tell. Now, there's just two kinds. There's the mental and then there's the non-mental. You won't be able to tell in those two classes one from the other unless somebody slips you a Turkish Murad with a little spot of hashish. Then the next thing you know, your eyeballs are bulging and you're ready, you know. But speaking of the exotic, this is WORAM with FM New York. Now, no one, of course, beer seems, the only reason that you seem to drink beer in these commercials is because you're at the beach. Now, they never really tell you why. They always talk about good taste and thirst. Those two things go together, but hardly ever do you ever see a guy rising from his pad bloodshot, eyeballs bugging out, head throbbing. He's had 14 of the new six packs, and that night, you know, that cured both his thirst and his quest for fun, and now the next day you can hear the sound of ka-tung, ka-tung, ka-tung. You know, you never hear that at all. Now that's part of it. Now, there's another thing, too, about beer commercials that must be stated. That Have you noticed that the crowds of people that run around all look like they've come out of the same mold? It is almost impossible to tell, for example, Miss Rheingold from all of her playmates, both sexes. It is very difficult to tell which one you're looking at. They run around, you know, and they're whoop, whoop, whoop. And if you notice very carefully in those commercials, that it seems like the same crowd does all the other commercials. They appear on the other beers one after the other. And the thing that I think is most intriguing about these beer commercials is that the people are the most unnatural-looking people that you can ever possibly find outside of the pages of Vogue. That's what I was watching these commercials scene. I was trying to figure out what was wrong with them. Why? What is wrong? The background is authentic. I mean, it's the real ocean. You know, that's an ocean out there. The sand is real. Or when they're running around, those are real trees. And I noticed it was a real horse showed up on one of them the other day. The only thing that's unreal is the people. Now, why are the people unreal? Well, I'll tell you. Just look around you now. Just seriously, look around you now and look at the slobs sitting around you. Well, now, you'll notice that these are genuine people. There's a fat one. There's a sweaty one, usually the same one. There's one with pimples. There's one that's lost his hair. There's one that, yeah, there's one that's bugged, that's smoking a cigar and doesn't care anymore. There's a very tall, skinny lady with an Adam's apple. These are people, you know. There's just a lot of a motley collection of folk. You know, there they are, just people. Well, now, you never see that crowd in the beer commercials. Have you noticed that? Now, I will say this about people. Out of any group of 15 or 20 people, you might find one that could, even by the remote stretch of the imagination, be called pretty. Pretty in the TV commercial, Vogue model, Hollywood sense. In fact, I would probably have to say 1 out of 100 comes even anywhere near. Somehow these commercials gather 9 of them together. And then it says, yes, when you're in the backyard having fun with the gang, and there's this whole crowd running around, these girls with the chiseled profiles and the no bosoms, and all the men with the chiseled profiles and the bosoms, and they're all running around, you know, like wild with their cashmere sweaters and their pearl teeth. It gives you a sense of total unreality, and you cannot at any point relate to that crowd, at any single point. I'd feel rotten if I got in that crowd. I don't know what I'd do. You know, I'd feel fat and everything else all at once, you know. And I'd feel fantastically tough. You know, for some reason or other, I started shaving at the age of 8. And I suspect that many of these guys won't be shaving by the time they're 50. Well, it's an intriguing thing to watch, you know, where they get these people. So I watch it, and then the voices never hardly ever match the people. Like there's this one guy who shows up on the television. He's always at a barn dance. Well, now looking at him, I know he talks in a high, thin, squeaky voice. And suddenly when he's talking, you can see it's been dubbed, you know. Here comes his voice. Come on. Yes, well, I was at the barn dance. Ring-a-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding. And yes, Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. Have you know? So you watch these things, and it's an intriguing situation to watch. What are they aiming this at? Now the question is that I have to ask you, does the commercial work? Do you relate to it? Do you really? Is Harry and Bert realer, and Harry and Bert are just cartoon people, are they realer than all the other people on the film commercials? I suspect they are. Isn't that a strange thing to say? They really are, by some odd. And then there's another one. There's another commercial that's almost startling in its unreality. There's a bunch of guys, and they're supposed to be just one of the gang. You know, the crowd, the gang, the boys are hanging around the tavern, and they're playing this game. You know, where you slide the little discs on the little bowling alley there, and they're playing this game. And you never saw such a crowd in your life. I'll tell you, expect the place to get raided any minute. You know, they're going to come in and bust the joint any second now. What a crowd. And yet you wonder just whether or not if there is a place that is like this. It can't possibly be. You know, it takes a lot of work to dig up 9 people. Yeah. Why then? Now the question arises. We can't put it off so quickly. is why is this? Because you see, the people who make the commercials also live in the real world. They are also fat and short and have pimples. Now, what dream world are they living in when they're sitting at their desk and they say, well, JB, we're going to cast a thing here. We got a commercial that says just a bunch of the boys hanging around the tavern. Now, would you call the agencies and send over just a bunch of the boys, you know, just ordinary guys. Yeah, Ricky and Dickie and Mickey and Bobby and Jackie. Yeah, just a bunch of the boys. Tell them to bring their cashmeres, yeah. Well, you just wonder what kind of nuttiness this is. What's this got to do with real life? You know, where does it stop? Well, now that's the way they do movies now. You know, maybe the guys who are making the little 58-second commercials are frustrated movie makers, because that's exactly the way. I'll never forget the insane picture of Tony Perkins playing Jimmy Pearsall. Great Scott, that's like Shirley Temple is standing in for King Kong. Holy smokes. I mean, this is an old movie gambit all the way down the line, you know. and I'm not putting down Tony as an actor. He ain't no center fielder, Dad. Especially of a Jimmy Pearsall ilk. I've seen Pearsall slide into home plate 30 feet out. I've never seen a guy come in with 17 feet. All of them with 9 spikes apiece. And as son of a gun, you know, I cannot quite see Tony in that role. But nevertheless, this is the way it goes, you know. But that's an old Hollywood gambit. Now, I guess perhaps this has rubbed off on the television world. However, I have a better solution. Maybe it's because I'm in that world and I deal with a lot of these people that perhaps I might have a solution that you don't know of. A couple of weeks ago, in the New York Times. In fact, it was a couple of weeks ago, about a week or so ago. They have an interesting little column. You should read this column. I think this column tells more about our world than, say, James Reston does. You know, I think politics follows the world rather than the other way around. You know, we like to think that the politics is the very important stuff. But if you keep an eye, a little sharp eye on the commercials, you keep a sharp eye on what yo-yos are being sold, you keep a sharp eye on whether they're buying cars with fins or not, you will find in the end that politics will follow that. It doesn't go the other way around. And so if you read what's happening in the world of the advertising, you might find out what will happen next year in the world of politics and the news. Oh, yeah, definitely. And here is a little item, a little column, by Peter Bart, who writes a lot of stuff for the Times. And this perhaps might explain a little bit of it to you, but there is a postscript which Mr. Bart did not go into, which we will have to discuss immediately afterwards. And now, please, if you will, from the New York Times advertising section. Well, fellas, did you read Bart this morning? Look, fellas, I'd just like to read this to you out loud. Now that nearly all the cigarette companies have taken to using male outdoor types in their advertising, a lively competition has developed among advertising agencies, fellas, listen to this, to find suitably virile-looking models. Ads for Chesterfield, Marlboro, Camel, Territon, L&M, and Lucky Strike, among others, all show robust, vigorous men, puffed contentedly in an outdoor setting. Now listen, Chucky, will you listen? This is about the business. Now sit up straight and listen, will you please? In many cases, the models shown are pilots, skiers, or cowboys to add to the masculine image. And we quote here, the purpose of all this hyper-masculinity is to build a virile, healthy image around cigarette smoking. Notes one researcher who has done some work for the cigarette companies. And I think you'll find this a scream, fellows. The job of finding models for the ads, virile models, has not been an easy one. No, indeed. One major agency that formerly used professional models in cigarette ads has now sent out teams, and this is rotten, fellows, isn't it, of account men to hunt for more authentic outdoorsmen. Dickie is not going to like that. And we quote once again, and I think this is a rotten thing to say, most New York models are far too delicate for us, says an agency casting director. Barton, Durston, and Osborne, Inc., recently recruited a square-jawed young telephone lineman for one lucky strike at and has signed the rascal up for other appearances. I'll be darned. The J. Walter Thompson Company, on the other hand, and I certainly like to see this trend, has relied mainly on obscure young actors for its Camel and L&M ads. If necessary, makeup is applied to roughen the actors' outdoor countenances to a proper masculine consistency. Ra-ta-ta. At one agency, a young account executive whose outdoor activities consist mainly of short walks in Central Park was asked to pose as a weather-hardened hunter. The arbiters of masculinity at most agencies are the chief casting directors, who are more accustomed to finding comely women for soap ads. Casting directors normally dislike being quoted in the press, but one noted candidly, "And here, people, is the hooker. The market for masculinity is tight these days. I'll be happy when we go back to ordinary-looking young people." Oh, boy. Well, now, I'll tell you one of the problems here that perhaps you people don't know. When they use the term casting director, do you know anything about the casting director? That's an unknown person to most of you. And I'd like to, all listeners who are in agencies exempted, and all agencies who might be listening, they too, of course, are exempted because they're square-jawed and honest and reliable, sober, industrial, and above all, virile. That you will find that the largest percentage of casting directors in New York agencies are large, square-jawed, angry ladies. Are you aware of that? Oh, yes. Now, oh, yeah, and you will find that this is one of the reasons why most of the ladies you find on television commercials are the exceedingly unfeminine type. Now, it's intriguing to find what a woman considers feminine and what a man considers feminine. They're usually poles apart. As a matter of fact, most men will find the average Vogue model picture exceedingly unfeminine. Exceedingly. The males who do find this a feminine image are usually guys with troubles of their own. Now, this is another complication which we will go into at a later date. However, and by the way, you'll find that most of the images of that femininity are engineered by that kind of male. You're aware of that. Dress designers, photographers, et cetera, layout men, all of whom have long ago, in their infancy, have abdicated their role in one way or another, and they've been playing house ever since. Now, oh yes, that's another problem there too. But then you get around to what a male considers feminine, you will find that most women are at a loss when they're confronted with that image. They really are thrown by that. They'll often argue with a man as to what is feminine, which is an intriguing problem there in itself. So when you find women, especially women who, and let me tell you this, it's a very difficult thing to become a casting director in an agency. There's only about, maybe a dozen top agencies in town. I'm talking about ad agencies that produce top flight commercials. The competition for a job like that is rough. This is a woman who has to be a special kind of woman. She is a very angry lady, usually. She is hard-driving. She has driven to the top. She has developed, in almost every instance, a deep-seated distrust for of and by and about males, almost invariably. She usually, too, has a deep-seated hatred of pretty girls, especially feminine ones, for obvious reasons, if you know any of them. This is another problem, too. So in the end, when they cast when they're casting, you'll find some of the strangest picks are made. As far as there'll be a commercial, the top of the commercial will read, a very masculine man is seen talking to a very feminine woman. The next thing you know, this girl will come in, and the girl looks more masculine than the man. You can't figure out why. Well, it's because the lady who is doing the casting, or the person who's doing the casting, thinks this is a feminine image. And it's, of course, diametrically opposed to true femininity. On the other hand, this type of woman usually relates boyishness with masculinity, two separate and distinct qualities. And so you will find more boyish people on television and more mannish ladies. It's an intriguing thing. You know, the difference between a man and a boy is great ladies. And the difference between boyishness and masculinity is a world of difference, too. And so you will find the grown-up boys, one after the other, because you see the grown-up boy fits that same image. Yes, it's an image that is very difficult for a lot of casting ladies to understand. And so Dickie will come running in with his tennis racket, and the girl will say, oh, you look so good, you're just so tanned, you were out at the island, weren't you, Dickie? And Dickie will say, oh, yes, by George. And he'll take a swish with that old tennis racket. And she thinks, you know, isn't he the most masculine thing? Of course, look at that wasp waist. And of course, Dickie, Dickie is playing the grown-up boy. And Dickie has been playing the grown-up boy role since he was probably 5 years old. And Dickie will play that role until he finally passes from this mortal sphere. When he dies at the age of 74, he will be roughly pushing 18. And he won't admit it. He will say, actually, I'm 16, but I look a little older than my age, you know. It's these big sweaters I wear. Well, this is a problem. I'm not taking off on these people. I'm not being a sadist. I'm merely pointing out why so many commercials seem to be so strangely unreal. You can't quite put your finger on it. And once in a while, a real commercial will show up, and you can't. You're thrown by it. You really are. And this perhaps explains why some of the most masculine images on television, nothingly enough, are cartoons. Mr. Clean, for example, is far more masculine than the people in the beer ads, and he's a cartoon. Perry and Bert. Typical example of that. And up and down the scale you go. And so I'm curious, though, whether or not the people who buy these commercials, now, the people who are in the agencies, most of them are large, hard-bitten, masculine types. I know many of them. Families, they, you know, they're digging the dirt, and they're you know, they played shortstop when they were 12. And yet, what spell are they under? What spell are they under? Now, then you go to the place where the guy makes the stuff. He's living among vats, and he's shoveling the malts and the hops from the bin, you know. And this guy's been chewing tobacco and hollering and fist-fighting since he was 12 years old. What spell is he under when he buys it? I'm curious. But the most intriguing of all is the big, fat, masculine guy sitting out there with his stubble. He's chewing on the butt end of his cigar, and he's watching the Mets play ball. What spell is he under when this strange little prancing troop show up in the middle of the ball game, and they're described as just a bunch of the gang out there having fun on the beach? What spell is he under when he nods and says, yeah, just like the gang? You know, and his friend Normie has just broken the door down to get in. And, you know, Normie is standing over there sweating. And he says, where's it, John? And he runs in, you know. And he looks nothing at all like this crowd. Hey, you give me a beer! And they're hollering, you know. He doesn't care what the... Pow, he opens the bottle of beer and drinks it down. And he's making a salami sandwich. Looks nothing at all like this crowd. And yet they'll all sit there and watch that crew and somehow identify with them. That's an intriguing thing. It really is. Do people see themselves as that? No, I don't think so. No, I don't think it's as simple as they want to think they look like that. I don't think so. The masculine image has left the movie screen. You're aware of that. to be replaced by the grown-up boy. There are dozens of grown-up boys working the wheat fields now. And the male image, as represented, say, if you're curious, you can see them on old movies from the 30s. The Spencer Tracys, the Clark Gables, the Cagneys, and so on. Now, remember something important. Those men played men from the first movie they made. That if you were watching, say, well, let's say Spencer Tracy playing a guy. He was a man. He was not called the boy in the script. There are two people in the script now, the boy, the girl, and the old father. Those are the three people that are in every possible variation of the movie script. There's no such thing as a man in the script. Now, by man, I mean all those thousands of males one sees walking about the streets that are masculine, that are capable of contending with their problems, that are not bugged, that are just walking around, are capable of enjoying being with a girl, and are not continually worried about their love life. It seems to come natural. That great number of men, who are millions, by the way, walking around, who are men from about the age of 19 on, has nothing to do with age now. Remember that. Nothing to do whatsoever with age. For example, let's take a typical example. Tab Hunter is older than most of the scenes you see played of the movies of the early 30s of Spencer Tracy. Are you aware of that? Yes. But Tab Hunter and Montgomery Clift and Tony Perkins, Rock Hudson, Tony Curtis, these guys will all be playing roughly 22 for the next 120 years. Now, the interesting thing about it is, of course, that there was no such thing as that a few years ago. I guess it's masculinity that they're running with. I'm not sure. It has nothing to do with age either. Age has very little to do with the situation. For example, there are many guys who are 19 years old running around Broadway and in the casting agencies who are considered too old for the roles that are being played by guys who are 35. In short, the masculine guys are weeded out. Now, I'm talking, then you have to define what masculinity is. There's a problem, too. It's an intriguing one. Well, now, that can be defined in many ways, mostly by what it isn't, really, just like love itself. What is femininity? If you see, say, for example, let's take a scene where Spencer Tracy is walking across the stage or across the screen with, let us say, Myrna Loy. Now, you knew they meant business. You knew that it was not a matter of she understanding him and comforting him, mothering him, in short. You could never imagine Myrna Loy mothering Spencer Tracy. Nor, on the other hand, him fathering her. Was something else going to happen? And yet, in most of our dramas today, Shirley or Shelley Winters will mother Ben Gazzara. Geraldine Page will mother Paul Newman. Or, on the other hand, when they decide they're going to be masculine, they usually go to a very older man, much older. If they're going to make a masculine movie, they generally get one of the old standbys. Jimmy Stewart, pushing 60 now, or better. Jimmy Stewart will be in love with Audrey Hepburn, playing 12. This is the masculine man. Now he's become father, you see. It's a very, that too is a subtle image. Jimmy Cagney, Spencer Tracy is always father now when he's playing. The late Gary Cooper, one of his last movies was a romantic love affair with Audrey Hepburn, a sad, terrible picture, where he played father. Cary Grant is eternally trying to make the scene, fall in love with a girl 40 years, at least playing 40 years, his junior. Where are the other guys? Well, they don't exist. They do not exist. I am aware, and many people in the theater are aware, that a man like, for example, Tracy, if Tracy were 23 today, he would have trouble finding a role on Broadway. being Tracy. And nothing to do with his acting. It has to do with his... If he did find a role, he would have to play the blind, unseeing father. He would be playing the heavy. He would be playing the heavy who is bullying the sensitive young hero, played by one of the boy-girl men. And speaking of the movie world, I think we got a little thingy there. Okay, hit it.
This is Radio Grand Fenwick, taking you to the United States Radar Control Center on the island of Bermuda. Take it away, Radar Control Center.
This is Radar Control Center. Momentarily, we will hear the first signals ever heard from the moon.
Hello there. This is the Grand Fenwick Space Team speaking to you from the moon.
Ladies and gentlemen, another country has beaten us to the moon. Tell us, what's the weather like on the moon?
If you're coming up, dress warm.
What about the composition of the moon?
Well, our microchemical examinations reveal that the moon is not made of green cheese.
No kidding. What else have you found out?
Well, the big song hits up here are Earth River, Blue Earth, and Shine On, Harvest Earth. Look, for further information, see Mouse on the Moon.
Mouse on the Moon?
Yes. The starring motion picture saga of Grand Fenwick's conquest of the moon in color.
Anything else?
Yes. Stop shooting at our moon.
Great Scott. The Mouse on the Moon is now playing at Cinema One. Stand back. I'm an eagle. You know, speaking of the Mouse on the Moon, I don't know anything about this picture, but the idea is intriguing. I wonder what Russia and America would do if Peru lands on Venus. You know, that's one of the secret fears of both of the big parties in the great conquest that's going on for men's minds in the world today, that the third party might grow up. Are you aware that third parties are popping up and that's bugging everybody? Sure. Why, De Gaulle? Why, De Gaulle makes both Russia and America sore. Not to mention China. I mean, China's got them worried on Saturn. When you got two big tough guys on the block, and they have been the two tough guys on the block for like 100 years, you know, and whenever there's any head belting, they do it. And there's two gangs, you know, there's my gang and your gang. When a third tough guy moves into the neighborhood, then you really got problems. The eternal triangle works not only in love, it works in hate, you know. And when you have a third party in there, both parties are bugged, and you would think that they would, you know, they wouldn't be, since they both hate each other ostensibly. Oh, no, they're very jealous of their hate. They don't want a third party to jump up and say, oh, if you think you hate him, Dad, wait till you hear what I got to say to Bob. Well, you know, I mean, believe me, there is many, for example, there is many a group today that is working for citizens' rights that is very angry about all the other groups that's working for citizens' rights because apparently they are cutting into their territory. And you would think they would all be glad to see, oh, no, why? There must be 25 Negro organizations, all of which hate each other. And that's true there are at least 45 white, colored, in-between peace groups, all of which hate each other. Because they figured that they were tilling the peace soil quicker and earlier and know more about it than those other guys that are going to. Johnny come lately. Listen, Mac, if you think you know about... Why, you're a Johnny come lately. You think you know about peace? I was for peace before you were even born, kid. What's that? Oh, yeah, what are you... Take that, you son of a... Next thing you know, they're fighting it over for peace, belting each other in the mouth as to who knows most about peace. But this thing of the peace and the arguments about who's big and who's important, these arguments about why the beer commercials look unreal, these are the things which really, in a sense, govern our later political actions. Believe me. That have you noticed that presidents look more and more like boy men? That ain't a coincidence. It is not. And they will continue to. They will continue to for reasons which are there, you know. The reasons are deep-seated, and these are reasons which, and this is not an anti-Kennedy remark. Not a bit of it. It's just a way of life, the way we are going, more and more. It will be. A man like Truman, for example, oh boy, I mean, he just doesn't fit any of those cigarette commercials. He's the real thing, you know? He just doesn't... Yeah, that's right. And I don't know what these people over at BBDNO would do if a genuine outdoorsman showed up. Or a real Maine farmer showed up, tracking up all those stainless steel elevators, you know? I'm not so sure what they would do if a real ball player showed up. The problems are manifold. And then again, I wonder whether or not they're worried about whether a real advertising man will come on the scene. Or a real casting director who really casts. Oh, it gets more and more wonderful as you go.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.